already in the systems. It's not new. It's not novel. It's not created. It's not thought. It's not creative thought. It's not you thought. So basically, what you're going to be left with is a lot of companies spending a lot of money on data centers that are going to end up being used for other things.
AC2GS. Well, there are things similar to the dot-com boom, and we've talked about that a load of times, but there's a lot of other things that are particularly worse than the dot-com boom. One of the big investments that initially didn't pay up were fiber optics. In order to connect data centers and the Internet, you need a lot of fiber optics. There are cables running across the ocean, the deep of the ocean, that are sending terabytes of data every second back and cross, back and forth. To different continents, and that was produced during the time of the dot-com bubble. When it burst, you couldn't use it because no one needed that much data. But as the years progressed, you know, Oracle lost something like 80% of their stock value. It took them something like 16 years to get back to the dot-com boom level. So, but the problem is it doesn't correlate easily with this AI stuff. NVIDIA is making boards that will be obsolete in 2 years. So you wouldn't be able to give it away. So people are investing in $1 trillion, and they better need to use it in the next couple of years because, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, they'll be practically worthless. So that's a big difference than the fiber optics that just sat there unused until people finally decided to use it, and they bought up the rights, and it's using a large percentage, I think basically 100% of the fiber optics that was laying during the dot boom are in use today. But that's not going to be the case with the data server farms. They'll be obsoleted by then.
You can't tweak this. What they should do is start small. And what I mean by start small is having a small data center and getting the software accurate. And that is no mean feat. It's a big task. It's a big task and a big ask to go ahead and get all this data straight. So instead of willy-nilly spending hundreds of billions of dollars and a trillion in some cases with companies going ahead and building AI, they don't even know what they're building, let alone, you know, putting into the, you know, into software, I think.
AC2GS. Well, but you got to understand, again, they're greedy bastards. You know, they're not going to make a lot of money if they start very small. And so they used, like I knew they were going to use, their trump card, which is reminiscent of the space race. You know, we were in an endless race with the Russians to land people on the moon, and we got there. And that's all real good. I loved it as a child. I love to get glossy pictures from NASA. They would give you anything for free. They didn't charge anything because they wanted the country to be interested in the challenge of it all. But the AI guys just will pull out the China card, and they'll say, we have to spend trillions of dollars because we have to be AI for the world. Because if we don't do that, the Chinese will do it first, and then we will lose. You know, so it's a matter of loyalty to your country to make sure that trillions of dollars are wasted in massive server farms that their neighbors hate and are starting to vote against. And such. So, you know, I don't think a lot of these server data farms are going to actually come to fruition. There's going to be a whole lot of partially built server farms out there as part of the mess that they'll leave behind. But I mean, again, this is just greed in action with a little bit of politicking included.
I agree. That's really all it is. At this point, I don't see. I mean, for the past year, I cannot see any appreciable difference in any of these AI clients or answers, rationale. You can't if you don't understand the human mind. Okay, you try to mimic it. You're only doing it superficially to where it pleases the ear.
Okay, but they do what it takes. These guys are hustlers, ultimately. They're not really, even though they tell you a story that they're looking for the advancement of mankind, they're not. They're looking for the advancement of their wallet. And they're very effective at doing it. A lot of what Elon has done is smoke and mirrors, but theoretically he's worth $800+ billion. Most of that is monopoly money. It's overinflated Tesla stock that's not worth what people think it is. SpaceX isn't worth what he thinks it is. IAX isn't worth what he thinks it is, but still. For the time being, he's got a lot of people snowed, and they regularly call him the richest man in the world. And all these guys want to be like him as well. So they're going to pull all kinds of scams, and they may end up like the guy who ran WeWorks, who had his own scam. But at the end of WeWorks, he walked away with $1 billion. Now that would mean a great deal to you or I. But to Elon, getting away with $1 billion is downright poverty.
Yeah, and the other thing is that wait until lawsuits start coming based on by inaccurate AI, in quotes, driven information. Okay? People get hurt by things that are said by AI or written by AI, and you're going to start to see really big lawsuits flowing, I think.
Well, you already see that. There are people who are suing Tesla for their make-believe auto drive software. There was a company, I think, in Canada that had an AI agent that gave discounts away that weren't valid that got sued. And there'll be more. There are cases of people who had AI psychosis who murdered their family. They're suing the AI company. So it's going to start as a trickle and continue on into a thunderstorm. But again, there's trillions on the line. So trillions in the present versus a billion or two in the future, these guys will throw the dice and take a chance.
The Jews, man. It's always the Jews.
Any other comments out there before we move on to the main segment?
No, just mine about the Jews. My comment about the Jews.
Okay, let's move on to the main segment. Questions, comments, topics. Hopefully the first few will be amateur radio related. This was a lively kind of Early edition. I hope the questions, comments, and topics is equally, if not more lively, but we'll see what happens. Hit that push to talk, give me your first name, give me your call sign, whether it's amateur radio related or science and technology.
And to Exgen, ham radio related.
Okay, Wes, noted. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay. This may yet be a relatively short technical net. Wesley, what you got for us tonight?
Yeah, Droid Star. Ultimate digital voice communication tool for amateur radio. So, when I was looking at all of those communication formats and ways to communicate, there was M17, Fusion, DMR, P25, NXDN, or NXDN that would be next generation digital narrowband, D-Star, All Star. Actually, we are being transmitted, translated, retranslated by All Star as well. As a matter of fact, I don't understand how come everybody has numbers, but Dr. Roy is listed with his call sign. How he did it. Anyhow, so All Star. And probably a few others. Now, the good thing is that it is good for Linux, Windows, Mac OS, Android, iOS, and whatever others, POS, 6 and platforms, QT. Okay, so once we have something that is Droid Star that could do all of that, we're talking about some sort of unification, or we're talking some sort of ultimate form of voice communication that could do all of that. Dr. Roy, you have a comment?
Not particularly. You're kind of making it a very, very, very broad topic because there's an intrinsic difference between digital voice radio, which is D-Star and Fusion and DMR and all the others, versus things that operate partially through voice over internet protocols, like Echolink and All-Star and IRLP and such. So they're kind of intrinsically different types of things, and they're not compatible. They're inherently incompatible. They all use different ways of accomplishing somewhat similar things, but not the same. And, you know, I think we talked many times before about there was this this guy who owns a communications company, Connect Systems, that was promising to have China build him a D-Star, DMR, and Fusion-based transceiver, and it never came to pass. The closest are people who have hotspots and go through gateways that are able to decode anti-talkies that are owned from ICOM and from Kenwood and from the other companies for the different versions of voice over digital voice over radio. So I don't think there's such a thing. And in point, they're coming up with yet another digital voice over radio waves called M17, which is also not compatible with all the others. So I think that no one's kind of up to a kind of universal version of this. There's just too many variants to juggle.
Comment.
Sure, Brian.
problem is that there is no single industry standard. For example, HDMI, single industry standard. USB, single industry standard. But when it comes to protocols, okay, there is no single industry standard when it comes to, let's say, using Wires X or Fusion or DMR or others. There should be one standard where everyone could go ahead and interact, and it's not there. I think that it's being done for marketing purposes, but for the good of the amateur radio community and the good of voice communications, it would be wonderful if they could all get together and create an industry standard, in my opinion.
Okay, but you bang into the same wall that we talked about earlier, capitalism. All these modes are proprietary setups that are licensed from each and every individual amateur radio manufacturer. ICOM has D-Star that they got from the Japanese Radio Club. Fusion, Yaesu has Fusion, and Motorola had DMR. All these guys are looking to make money. If they have a universal standard, then you'll buy the cheapest universal standard. You won't buy theirs. So they have a vested interest, monetary urge to make theirs proprietary and non-interchangeable, like Sony used to in the good old days of their business, when every single battery pack and connector was proprietary and you had to buy it through Sony. Apple tried to do that with Lightning, and the European Union kind of shut them down and made them standardize on micro USBs. But unfortunately, I don't think the European Union cares enough to force Japanese communications companies into standardizing. So it's a nice sentiment, but unfortunately, it's not the way economy works.
Well, the Ethernet is based on standards, okay? The Internet is based on standards. Now, if you have a standard for this type of IP voice communication between disparate systems, you could build applications that that differentiate from one vendor to another, and it would be a lot easier to go ahead and have some interoperability without having gateways and other hardware and more things. So I do think that it has to do a lot with marketing. No question about that.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, if a company was powerful enough and the total number of customers were relatively small enough, I could easily see some fools coming up with their own proprietary internet protocols packets, so that, you know, without your decoder from Dell, your digital signals would only work inside your house. The going out to the router would require a translator. But again, the economic dynamics are different. If they tried to do that, massive countries would sue their backsides and kill them. So they have to settle on non-proprietary standards. Amateur radio companies don't. No one really cares. The European Union, you could use all kinds of proprietary connectors for everything in your radio, and they won't care.
And I give the European Union a lot of credit for adopting USB-C as the interface of choice, because they set a standard, okay, for what they want in the European Union, and I just hope that, well, it seems like Apple capitulated, and I just hope it extends to every facet, because you can have different standards, especially in electronics. I mean, some are going the way of the dinosaur already. USB-C is now the standard of where it's at.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I think another example of the standard problem is all these streaming stations. You know, years ago, you know, you had a TV, and if a company wanted to transmit to your house, they had to pick a station, channel 2, 4, 5, whatever it is, and you would just click and find that station. Now, have dozens of these streaming stations, you know. Now you got to pay separate for each individual station, you know, instead of having, okay, there's the streaming section, and you can click around to all the different possible shows that are on. That doesn't exist. I think, you know, that there's no standard on that as well.
82FIU? Yes, George. We're ham radio operators. The standards are set by the IARU. Industry standards, industry, apply to broadcasting and what you're paying for. We have different parameters. We are allowed different data rates for a different voice. Everything is within we want to do and what we're licensed for. Industry standards on what should be in digital or voice modes is not up to that. Broadcasting standards or personal communication standards. We have different standards.
Yeah, but what we're talking about are beyond the external radio standards. The standards are symbol rate or bandwidth or frequency range or what have you. You know, there's nothing in the laws regulating that your data input has to be a USB connection.
That's right. It doesn't. Neither does your antenna connection. Neither does your power connection.
Yeah, but the problem is that when every proprietary digital voice mode comes online because of financial reasons, there's no real regulation that says you can't do it. They all pretty much kind of do the same type of thing, but ever so slightly different, so that they simply are not compatible with each other. The same frequency range, they use binary code, but they arrange the packets a little bit different and the protocols a little bit different. And so functionally, you can't really use a handy talkie A for repeater B. And there's nothing requiring that in any kind of radio rules, because they're looking fundamentally at the radio aspect of the technology, not the implementations of packet arrangements and such.
KD2HD.
Okay, precisely, Roy, and they don't have to, because it is a hobby.
Well, I mean, even if it was commercial, Motorola is basically a commercial company, and DMR used to be a commercial mode. But, you know, if you could monetize it, if it happens to give you benefits and doesn't screw up everyone else's life, most likely laws won't be written to get you into trouble. Again, the European Union is not going to issue some fiat on DMR. They have no interest in doing anything like that. Jim, you wanted to say something?
Thank you. It's one topic. The way I understand it, in the amateur world, it's not supposed to be a standard. We're supposed to be experimenting. That's the whole point of this game, as it were. While it can be a little frustrating with all the different types of transmissions out there, that's part of what's supposed to to happen here, as I understand it. What's not supposed to happen here is the proprietary system. That is what's occurring. That's not supposed to be the case. It's supposed to be open source type thing, so everybody has an opportunity to play the game with it and try it out and whatnot. The way I understand this way, this world is supposed to work on amateur radio. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Thank you, Jim. It's worldwide. Roy, I'm sorry. I just had to say that because he was saying he's on track what I'm saying. Thank you. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I have something to add. Well, the applications I was talking about, 28STAR and 28GM, is the Apple Store, Google Play. It's for Windows 64, 32, Linux, and for other applications, Mac, iPhone, and you can download it. You can see if it works or it's not. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of DroidStar. They had a beta test in iOS for Apple about a year or two or three ago, and then they just let it lapse, and then they canceled it. So it's one of those strange guys, you know, they do open source, I guess, maybe. You know, they're not really fully functional. So if you happen to have an Apple device, there's no software for DroidStar. And, you know, again, it's another proprietary method. And just to go back a little bit to what Jim said, the problem I have is that although to a degree our hobby is experimental, in point of fact, if you kind of tried to figure out how many people build their own transceivers versus how many people put together their own wire antennas, I think it's 99.99 to 1. You know, unfortunately, it takes a lot of research and development and brains and time and effort to come up with your own mode. So ultimately, this is not something that one guy does by himself. Sometimes it's a club that does it together. Sometimes it's a company that does it together. But still, I mean, and ultimately, it tends to always end up being tied to financial purposes. You know, the Japanese Radio Club is paid a license via ICOM to use D-Star, and ICOM promotes their ICOM products because they include D-Star. So although it would be very, very true, Jim, back 100 years ago, nowadays it's very few people experiment by building their own types of transceivers. I mean, the closest thing is M17. But again, I think rather than kind of turning it into a universal mode, it's a further little island in the Balkans. You know, it's another place that people kind of get stuck. They have a M17 radio that does M17. So your friend next door that does DMR can't talk to you, you can't talk to him. And, you know, rather than kind of merging the lanes, we're dividing them into narrower and narrower lanes.
I disagree, Roy. If we're permitted to do it with our licensing systems, then do it.
Well, you can think big as much as you want. I mean, unfortunately, we have fellow hams who, if you ask them how a radio works, they would tell you, you plug it in and you turn it on. So, again, I mean, there's a couple of guys down on 75 meters who are working brilliantly with new digital modes of linear amplifiers for their AM transmitters, but that's the exception to the rule. Most of us take out our credit cards and either buy a used radio or a shiny new one. We don't kind of spin our own. And, you know, to expect guys, Joe Schmo, to kind of suddenly know enough about electrical engineering to have something that's, you know, state-of-the-art transceiver, I'm sure there are guys out there who can do it, given the time and motivation, but 99.99999 can't, and so they don't. And so we're kind of stuck with intrinsic standards, and especially, you know, no one makes any extra money by selling a FM radio. You know, FM modulation is out of patent, and you don't have to pay anyone anything to build and design an FM radio. But DMR and D-Star and Fusion, they all have AMBI chips for the most part, and you have to pay someone for all these things, no matter what you do. Unless you go M17 that uses an open source codec.
Quick comment.
Sure, Brian.
If a product is successful, okay, and like Apple, for example, they could command a proprietary interface like Lightning and make a lot of money, okay? But in the end, people get smart, like the European Union. They said, you know, we have 10 different interfaces. We're going to just settle on one. Take it or leave it.
Amateur radio is not about that.
No. I know amateur radio isn't about that. I'm just talking about, basically things that are, that are basically proprietary. And amateur radio isn't about that. It's about inventing and checking and research and doing all kinds of experimentation. And, you know, I understand that. I'm totally fine with that, of course. But I'm just saying, in general, any company that makes something that's proprietary and it's in demand will be a moneymaker.
Okay, you also have to keep in mind that it took the European Union something like 15 years to get them to stop using Lightning cables. So, you know, powerful forces on both sides and a lot of time. It didn't happen overnight.
Yeah, I would like to go to another topic.
Okay, is everyone else done with this one?
Hey, K2STP?
Yes, Chris.
Just wanted to let you know, your live stream seems to be streaming a different repeater, in case you didn't know that.
Ah, no, I didn't. Well, that's strange, because there's a lot of people on the stream. You would think that if it was pointed at the wrong place, they would kind of notice and at least turn off. So are you sure yours isn't connected to the wrong repeater?
I'm just going to the normal link that I have for the website, but maybe it's on my side. Okay. I thought maybe he was streaming something else temporarily and forgot to switch it. All right. K2STP.
Okay, well,
I have two subjects related to science, because Dr. Roy is more into chemistry. It's actually good. So, we have a highly efficient slow-release wood-burning stove and reaction, designed to heat spaces using 80 to 90% less wood than conventional soap. And it burns wood in vertical insulated heat riser, creating a hot, clean burning vortex that directs heat through the mass of carbon masonry. So you have a sort of bench that you can heat, and the next 24 hours is giving heat out, and it could go through entire house. But for some reason, it is banned in most of the states, not all of the states. And this thing is called Rocket Mass Heater, RMH. I wanted to know what Dr. Roy thinks about it, please.
Not a great deal. Again, cause, you know, in Brooklyn, there's not much call for a wood-burning heating system. I don't know. It seems like you have the impression that there's some health risk involved in this. It's more of a bureaucratic regulation that if it isn't the standard model, and since it's built on site, every model is different. It has to be tested with an expensive procedure that's not cost effective. So I think the way that the video itself said is, you know, in order to test a particular model can cost $30,000-$40,000, which is fine if each model is identical, then you just test one model and you sell a couple of thousand of the same model. But since they're built on site and each one is dimensionally different, you have to test every single different dimension. And that means that, you know, every wood-burning heating system would add an additional $30,000 for testing.
Yeah, I believe you hit it exactly in the point. It is high efficiency, low emission, thermal mass storage. I mean, bends up source heat from the exhaust, storing it for longer term or slow radiation. The safety and design, it's kind of questionable. It is safe, but it's for each. So in other words, guys who have money, they can have the best one, and this is the best one, looks like. Using 10%, 20% of wood, as you would use 100% of them. Versatility. Could be used for space heating, cooking, and hot tub, or even water heating. So, all of the stoves are regulated. But this one is like a custom-made. None of them is exactly identical. Is it that? Why it is banned in most of the states, but to you?
Yeah, according to the video you sent me, that's what's going on. You have to have it measured, and you have to have a certificate. And since they're all unique, and you can't afford to test it, the expense of the way the testing goes, you simply can't get it approved. So if it can't be approved, then it's ultimately banned. So, you know, I mean, if you want to pay $30,000, you could probably, as a special situation, get it approved, get a certificate and such. But almost no one is willing to do that. And so it's not banned out of a flaw in its design or some dangerous aspect. It's simply a bureaucratic problem. It's kind of like, you know, these esoteric, very expensive, multi-million-dollar foreign cars. That they don't want to have tested by the government, and since they don't release one for testing, they can't get approved. And once they can't get approved, if you buy it, you have to leave it in your garage for the rest of your life.
Isn't it that they have also? I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not in this field, but I know that they have the airplanes. They are experimental. And they are exempt from most of the rules. Do we have the same about cars? Back to you.
I don't know. It's within the realm of possibility that bureaucracy had a get out of jail card. You know, maybe his brother-in-law owned that company or something. I don't know. But as far as that video was concerned, the premise is I took it was simply that it's a bureaucratic limitation, that you have to undergo an expensive test to ensure its safety, and if it's a different configuration, it has to be done all over again. And so if you have two models, you have to send two models for testing. If you have an infinite number of models, then you can't afford it.
Okay. So it looks like if somebody of the listeners, ham radio operators, has enough of money and willingness to save money on heating, they can do it, and it works. Another video that I have sent you was this magic fuel and magic engine is real and it works, question mark, of course. And in Europe, there is a company called MAN, M-A-N, and it's the German company that was making trucks for Hitler. And now they are on the top of the top of the top of everything. Let me drop. And they are for military operation, application, and heavy transport, whatsoever. So they make a truck. And they are testing some sort of magic engine. And because Dr. Roy is more into chemistry and I'm not, I'm sorry. If you would, you have it in email that I have sent you that was February 26, 2026 at 11:20 a.m. That was 3 days ago. So, zero carbon emission, high energy density, corrosive properties, well, it is corrosive, but that engine can deal with that. Environmental concerns. Well, it has a nitrogen oxide, a technological challenge, the development of ammonia, because ammonia is used in those engines, requires specialized components, but that engine is good for ships, and in the entire ship, like a cargo ship, you could have only four-cylinder engine, and it's going to work. So, before I go to what is not good about it, Dr. Roy, and to Xian.
Well, I mean, the big thing is what's bad about it, and it's very bad. And I don't know if you've ever experienced relatively strong ammonia. The stuff that you can buy at the store is very dilute, relatively medium strength, even low to medium strength ammonia. If you get a whiff of it, it'll knock you on your tuchus. I know. I foolishly, I had a little teeny beaker of this stuff, and I just kind of wafted it at arm's length, and I coughed for the rest of the day. Ammonia is a very noxious gas. It's a strong alkaline. It's a noxious gas. It'll burn your lungs, and too much exposure can ultimately kill you. So, I mean, yeah, if you spill a little gasoline in your garage, but so what? Who cares? You spill a little ammonia in your garage, and you're lucky if you get back from the hospital. So it's a very dangerous, you know, there are a lot of high energy fuels, but you have to kind of balance it with the risk benefits, and there's a lot of risks versus benefits to ammonia as fuel. It's like, you know, nitroglycerin probably would be a great fuel if it didn't blow up.
Yeah, to exchange. Yeah, coal is highly toxic gas made from nitrogen and hydrogen. But the MAN, the number one company in the world, German technology is working on it. Okay, anyhow. Something for Paul and you, Dr. Roy. So, Paul, I sent you also the seismic stations Apollo, and it is about seismic activity on Luna. On Moon, yeah, that's the right word. So it was 1969 and 1972. Apollo Lunar Surface Experiments Package was there, and there was Apollo 11, Apollo 12, 14, 15, 16, 17, and somebody would say, seismic activity on Moon. Moon is dead. Moon doesn't have a hard core, a pole, if you don't mind to take a microphone and explain to us.
Okay, Roy, do I have it?
Yep. Yep, you have it.
Okay. Yeah, Wes, that used to be Dick's favorite topic when it came to moonquakes, and he used to talk about the ASVAB stuff that was left on the moon, the Apollo Lunar Surface Exploration Package. Oh, I didn't get a chance to read it, but that was the, they were great. I mean, like you said, there were half a dozen of them. Every mission that landed on the moon, there were six missions that landed on the moon. They left one of those packages behind. And the first one was the only one that was solar paneled. And little solar panels attached to it was able to operate. And it was to detect quakes, but they did other things too. They were looking for magnetic field and all signs, half a dozen signs, different things that were attached to ASVAB. And the later ones, after 11, they all ran on RTGs for power, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators. And they didn't put out as much power as today's RTGs, but enough to do what I had to do for those systems. Let me drop it a second. Yeah, I know they did successfully detect moonquakes, and I don't know how many, but they did. But the thing I always found interested in is, let's say, Apollo 12 or any of them that left the moon, they left with the ascent stage. You know, the descent stage stayed on the moon, but the ascent stage went up with the, sent the crew back to lunar orbit to dock with the command module. But that ascent stage would be separated, before the LEM would dock with Apollo, and that would crash back into the surface. For that matter, the LEMs themselves, I think, except for one, I think Apollo 10, did not do that. But they always crash back into the moon. Every time they crash back into the moon, the moon detectors, the ASVAB, would detect the impact. And these things worked for years because they had the RTG. They ran on plutonium-238. So, like all the RTGs do. And they would run for years, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, whatever it was. So, yeah. That's all I know about it, Wes. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, I recall when I was working in geophysics. Murphy Volcanic Corporation, that was a copper mining industry. One of the methods that was widely used, which was the method that was used also before the Second World War, was seismic method. So there was the explosive that was blown to create a seismic activity, and geophones were put on the surface of the Earth just to measure all of those frequencies, and then they were able to create the cut off of that, and then with the time the technology changes in year 2000 before 9/11. Actually, yeah, that was before 9/11. My company patented it. I cannot hear the beep. Okay. My company patented the resonance acoustical profiling system, which was able to look to the depth of 1.8 mile and see everything beneath the ground level, what is there. Of course, the system had the flaws, but it could detect definitely almost everything, so you saw the difference between clay and gravel and the rock, and you could see the pipes, bunkers, whatsoever. And that's why it was also in Army Rangers base, making a speech in front of the scientists there. Ladies and gentlemen. Okay, and that was Columbus, Georgia. But then that was the very, very simple technology. You just put the geophone with the piezoelectric foil on the ground, and instead of explosives, you use the hammer. So in the vicinity of that sensor, you just knock with the hammer. That sound traveled down, and then all of the layers reflected the frequency, and they respond with their own frequencies of resonance, I would say. And then those frequencies were analyzed by a simple photostyler, and the signal from the piezoelectric foil was sent from analog to digital converter, and then read by early versions of the Windows. Let me jump. Okay, but when I'm looking at the article, it says that on the moon there was 13,000 seismic events revealing that moon is geologically active, and it was deep moonquake. So we're not talking about meteors or small bodies hitting the surface of the moon. We're talking about something inside. I found that very much interesting. I wanted to find out why is that happening. And one of the explanations is that it is the gravitational influence of the Earth that does that. Let's jump. So I'm gonna read the quote. Moonquake type. Scientists identified four distinct types: deep moonquake driven by earth tides, shallow moonquake, potentially tectonic, thermal quakes from thermal changes, and meteoroidal impacts. So question to Paul is it any activity of the moon inside the moon that is internal, not external? But to
years ago, they do have some kind of evidence that the inside of the moon does have some kind of molten core to some degree, and that might still be active. But I'm not really the earthquake guy, you know. I wish we still had John here from you remember him, of course, from Staten Island. He was actually building his own somebody. He used to talk about that thing. But, I think it was slightly active. Yeah, of course, I was more interested in if the moon was hit with a meteor, and I believe that any time that it was hit with anything, that these packages that they left on the moon would pick it up. In fact, I'm trying to think back, it was even picking up the footsteps as they walked around on the moon, sending, transmitting that information back to Earth. But yeah, I don't have any other further comment on that. Wes, back to you.
I wonder if Dr. Roy heard something about that and could make a comment. Dr. Roy?
Sorry, Wes. I'm not really a geologist, so I don't really keep up with those things. By the way, I looked up a couple of little things about Droid Star. Very unimpressive. I basically have a similar piece of software called BlueDV. It's really just a glorified hotspot. You have to supply your own AMBI USB device to your computer, and it doesn't operate on the repeaters. It operates on the backbone of the gateways. So nothing particularly special about DroidStar.
Oh, thank you very much for that information and for explanation. I didn't try that. I thought that might be somebody on the TechNet who would make a comment, so thank you very much, Dr. Roy. Back to you.
Yeah, that's all I have to really say. It's, like I said, the BlueDV is a really nice guy someplace in Europe that does this for free. He did Peanut. He's done a whole bunch of other pieces of software completely for free, so it's very nice of him.
Hopefully some of the ham radio operators will try and share their own experience with something that would be more unified, something that would allow to operate in few areas together, all together, without major problems. Back to you.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the closest that you'll get is either a hotspot or a glorified PC-based hotspot, where you go to the different gateways and you're highly dependent upon people hooking gateways to other gateways, and you got all kinds of problems because sometimes the gateways break completely, sometimes they turn into a one-way street, so you'll hear someone coming in from one gateway but not going back down the same route. So, there's not, I think, a lot of motivation, especially with the ubiquitous nature of hotspots these days. Almost everyone with the slightest interest in digital modes have bought themselves at least one, if not two or three or four hotspots.
Thank you very much for that. So for those who are interested with moon and moon earthquakes, there is a video on YouTube. It's called Apollo Lunar Surface Experiment Package. Apollo Lunar Surface Experiment Package. That's how it is being called. It's by Wiki Audio. You could actually listen to that. There are few others, but it's interesting. Who think that we have some sort of a seismic activity on the moon? 13,000 events recorded. 13,000 seismic events. Unbelievable. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy, and I'm done for today.
Okay, very good, Wesley. Thank you for your participation, as always. So, we're at 10 o'clock. We theoretically have about 15 more minutes if anyone wants it. You know, if you want to bring up some previous topic that got tabled, feel free. So if you have any questions, comments, or topics,